it feels like it's been a long time, but then like a short time because it's been super fucking busy. And I think just because we've been knocking out all these interviews for the film festival, and then you've been handling that shit like a champ. So thank you for that. But yeah, no, it feels like we haven't done this like a proper one of these in a minute.
For real.
And we will be a minute until, because we still have so many fucking interviews from the film festival. Like we got to figure out how we're even going to handle that shit.
Man, we had a chance to sit down with so many badass filmmakers, producers, actors, writers, like, and just talking about their projects, what they're working on. I mean, I've probably got 15 to 20 like interviews of just gold in there that I got to mine out.
People were posting a bunch of stuff on Instagram, a lot of like behind the scenes, I guess, if you will, of like them being interviewed on our podcast, which is dope because there was another podcast that was there and it seemed like ours was like the one that had the line. So like people got lined up to talk to you, man. That shit was awesome.
I mean,
feeling all of that too.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was awesome. Connecting with everybody was such a fucking joy. Like, hopefully it comes through in the recordings, and hopefully that, you know, we can strip out some of the sound in there too, because we were in that hall that had some amazing acoustics. Please hear that sarcasm.
Yeah, man. I mean, the alternative is to bring like those sound absorbing boards, but that's got to go like in your face around the table or whatever, and it looks like super awkward. But
that would make a lot of sense, and it would have been the right way to go. But we're a low budget podcast. We're 100%. Talking about low budget movies, but we hooked someone who wasn't low budget.
See how you segue?
I don't know. That wasn't a good segue.
This one is a special one. So it didn't dawn on me, although I had this on my radar for a little bit because I wanted to do something special for it. But it didn't, I just lost track of it. And you were the one that pointed out that we are hitting our 100th episode with this episode. So I don't have like do I have an applause track?
Yeah.
100 episodes, man. It's fucking awesome. I don't know if you got any coffee or whatever, but kudos. Cheers.
Cheers, brother.
There you go. A couple thoughts. Hitting 100, right? It's a huge milestone for, I think, for any podcast. But the first and foremost, it definitely makes me miss Matt. He's the one who started all this with me, you know, and I know he's off, you know, doing his own thing, and but you know, we stay in touch, and he's got some ideas for stories and things like that, and you know, good to know that he's, you know, still getting along, but definitely miss him in this moment where we're hitting such a milestone.
Couldn't be here without him.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. What I'd wanted to do was kind of like what Best of B Horror refers to as a super cut, you know. So I was like, oh, it'd be dope to like take every movie that we've reviewed and make like a montage, maybe like 1 or 2 seconds of each, and do like a video montage and post that up on Instagram as like a celebratory, like 100, we did it. But that requires a lot of time, which it was on my mind to do it, but I lost track of it and it fell off my radar. And then you were like, hey, this new episode is going to be our 100th. And I was like, how fucking dope that the stars aligned, that this episode be 100, and for us to interview the person that we interviewed, right? It's fucking awesome, man.
One of the most influential people in my horror movie journey, like where I started.
What got and who is that? Who is that? Who are we talking about?
This is Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street series, Heather Langenkamp.
Dun dun dun.
Dude, such a sweet lady.
I was so nervous going into that interview.
I still am nervous and I'm editing.
which is crazy because you'll hear after this one, we interviewed Mick Strawn, who is the or was the art director for Nightmare 3, 4, and then Freddy's Nightmares as well. And then he's done a ton of other shit, like non-horror. Like he worked on Blade. He's responsible for the blood rave in the first one.
Yes, the opening scene.
100%. Special effects on Boogie Nights. Like the dude just worked on a ton of shit, right? And so that interview was super chill, very laid back. Like I could have talked to that dude for hours. But then afterwards, talking to Heather was like, she's horror royalty, you know? And I think that's what the difference was, is like, you know, Mick is the guy who makes things happen behind the scenes, which like I can relate to more. But then Heather is, you know, front of the camera, talent, horror royalty. So I was like, oh, a little nervous there, but super sweet, so laid back, so relatable, so, you know, down to earth. And it was a great interview, nonetheless. Sorry. Yeah, 100%. And you know, we're trying to do a few things with her now that we have a, you know, line of communication with her, and trying to see what we can do to, you know,
hopefully connect again in the future.
Cool nightmare stuff as well. But yeah, man, 100 Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street. Who would have fucking thought, dude?
I don't know. I'm still without words. Like, there's a point in the interview even when you go, Alan's got a ton of questions, and I'm like, can you just tell me about your journey?
You're Nancy.
Yeah. Do you know that? Do you know that you're Nancy?
That reminds me of Chris Farley on SNL when he's interview people. He's like, hey. Do you remember in Nightmare on Elm Street when you were dreaming and Freddy and you burned your arm so you could wake up? That was awesome.
That's exactly what it was like. That's exactly what it was like.
All right. Well, yeah, I don't know what else there's to say other than, you know, thanks for sticking around for 100 episodes. It's been awesome. We've, you know, really had a good opportunity to do some cool shit, some dumb shit, you know what I mean? Have a really good time with it. We've met a ton of people along the way. We've been very privileged to be able to talk to a lot of these people, to be on set and to work with them. I know, you know, you've got some stories about working with, you know, Elfmans and, you know, yeah. I don't know that any of that stuff is possible without this podcast. And this podcast exists, you know, to help entertain people, and you know, we get interaction and people want to hear it, people want to see it, and so we keep doing it, and it's just given us the opportunity to do some really cool stuff. So thankful for everyone who listens, downloads, and interacts with us, and looking to do a lot more of that stuff moving forward. So yeah, man, happy 100.
Yeah, and I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did.
All right, everybody, 100 episodes, Heather Langning Cap, Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street. Here you go.
Hey, hey.
How's everyone?
We're great. How are you?
Doing beautiful.
Doing great.
That's awesome.
Hey, you're Paul.
And you're Paul, yes, and that's Alan. I'm pointing this way so you guys can see me. I'm sorry, we're all over the place.
Nice.
Hey, so if you don't mind, okay. I'd love to hit the record button real fast just because I don't want to forget that part. Perfect.
Do it.
Recording in progress.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. I think to say that are beyond excited to talk to you is a little bit of an understatement. You have a large presence in both our childhood and influence in our cinema upcoming. So it's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you very much.
Of course.
And you too, Alan. Thank you.
No, the pleasure's all ours. Believe me.
We both have funny stories about not meeting you.
Really?
So I had bought this custom-made Nightmare on Elm Street poster, and you and Robert were attending an event here in Pasadena in California. Robert had to back out at the last minute because he got COVID. And then I had assumed that you were going to be there all weekend. And so I was like, you know what? I'm not going to bombard her table Friday or Saturday. I'm going to come on Sunday when it's a little bit lighter. And then I showed up on Sunday and then I couldn't find your booth. And then it turned out you were only there Friday and Saturday.
For one day. Oh,
yeah.
That was terrible. That happened a lot during, those years.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Maybe I can sign it for you. Now. We can meet on the 134 or something like that. There
you
go.
You are not the first person to propose that
we meet on the 405 to the 101 to the 134 and get off it.
While standing in traffic.
Yeah. Most
more than likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I want to say thank you to Roy Wagner as well. He was the one who was kind enough to help set this up. As you know, he's going to be attending the second annual Happy Fright Film Festival. We've been second year that we're putting this on now. We're trying to help bring awareness to the theater here in Fillmore. We're a very small town, and the theater is a single screen. It's a stage theater, fits 300 people. It's a nonprofit, and the owner has only owned it. Yeah, he's only owned it for 2 years now, maybe. And we're trying to bring awareness from within the community back to the theaters. He's restored it as much as he can so far, showing movies now.
Up north near San Francisco, right? Fillmore?
No. People get that confused because I think there's a Fillmore theater up in San Francisco. But the city of Fillmore is here off the 5, right on the other side of Castaic and Santa Clarita. So we're right where Magic Mountain is.
I know that, Fillmore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. So that's super close. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
Right next to Santa Paula and Ventura and on the way to Santa Barbara.
Of course. I know exactly where you are. Yeah. It's beautiful there. Very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. A lot of people who came out for the first time last year for the film festival compared our community and the street in which the theater resides to that of like a Hallmark town, a Hallmark movie town. Because it just has that nostalgic classic feel to it. So, Roy was kind enough to come out last year and, sit with us for a little while. And he'll be attending this year. We're screening Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. And
what night are you doing that? What night are you showing it?
Friday night. So that'll be the 17th. Yeah. And we really like the Friday we really like the Friday shows because it's a single showing. It's the only movie, it's the only singular movie for the festival. Last year, all day Saturday was booked up. And then this year we're doing 2 days, Saturday and Sunday as well. So we'll have filmmakers in and out, a lot of independent filmmakers, a lot of people who are brand new to the industry, some industry people will be there. So it's a whole cavalcade of different levels of experience, but the Friday night is the intimate one, and I really enjoy that one. Great. So Roy's going to be there. We'll do a screening. We'll do a Q&A, and hopefully
he'll be the perfect person to talk to. I mean, his work is so incredible in that movie, and it was very groundbreaking in a lot of ways too. I'm sure I'll talk about that too.
Yeah, it's funny because this last weekend I talked to Mick Strawn. And we did an interview and he was talking about some of his vision and art direction for the look and the feel of the film. And we really kind of talked about how part 3 is the transitional piece in the series that moves us from who or what is Freddy to what we know of Nightmare on Elm Street to be now, with all the whimsical kills and the one-liners and the whole nine. And so it's really started in part 3, which I think Alan and I kind of agree is, like I said, that transitional kind of groundbreaking film. Yeah.
Very true.
So, I don't know. I know Alan's got a ton of stuff he wants to talk to you about. He's a super fan over there. And
I know. I feel my lighting is all so bright, but there's no need changing unless I move back a little bit. But
I feel very
washed out.
You look great.
I haven't gotten my Zoom, thing happening. lately. I haven't been doing as many Zooms, so I don't have like the perfect setup. But yeah, fire away. I'd love to know. Yeah, I'd love to hear what questions you have for me. I'm wondering if I've ever heard them before.
I have one that I'll wait until the end because I don't want to derail us, but I'm hoping it's not one that you've heard before, but we'll get to it. We'll get to it at some point. I don't know, Alan, if you want to start. I'm sorry. I'm super nervous. So I'm kind of all over the place.
I hope you won't be nervous. I don't want you to be nervous. So.
All right. I appreciate that.
It's admiration fully. I just kind of wanted to hear a little bit of the story. You know, it's been told so many different ways, but like the story of how you went from Nightmare on Elm Street 1 and, you know, starting with that role and then getting called back for 3. And then, I mean, even later, then you've got the new Nightmare, which is like, to me, mind blowing. The first time I'd ever even seen something in metaverse, like, I know it wasn't the first time it was ever done, but the first time I'd ever seen it.
Well, so after I did the first Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, we weren't really aware for many years that it was going to be a hit. I mean, it did well in the theaters, but then it left the theaters. And before, you know, the VCR was invented, I never saw Nightmare on Elm Street again. I only saw it the one time. Maybe I saw it twice, you know, when it was in the movie theaters. And then you just don't even think about your movie because there's no place to see it. You can't, you know, people just don't really understand that. Once something was out of the theater, it was pretty much gone unless they were going to show it at a midnight showing on TV. And so I think there were a couple of times that it was shown really edited down severely on television, on like on cable TV. And, you know, and it still didn't really strike me as a very popular movie. They made the second movie and I didn't even really hear about it or really know about it. I just kind of heard in the background, like, oh, they made a sequel. And so the movie really wasn't like a blockbuster, like the way you think about them today, but obviously they were making some good money and Bob Shea had the brilliant idea of letting Wes, write the third script. And so Wes put that together. And because Wes really has always thought that Nancy and Freddy were a, you know, dynamic duo that, you know, the different sides of the same coin, he brought Nancy back and he did call me and let me know that he'd written this script and Nancy was in it and that he hoped that I would do it. And at that time in my career, I was pretty much taking anything that came my way. So of course I said, yes. And I have to say, I was a little bit disappointed that he wasn't going to direct it, but I knew that Chuck Russell, you know, he'd just come off of some big movies and, you know, I met him and he was a really great guy. So, you know, I knew that it was in good hands. And it was when I met the kids who are going to be in the show, we all got together for several kind of pre-shooting get-togethers just so that we could, you know, I guess meet each other and get more comfortable with each other. At that time, I really realized that the cast was so amazing and everybody was just such a real down, not only down to earth, but also just had this great acting style, really organic group of kids who were also excited to be in the movie. Frankly, they are all really, really, really excited. They had, you know, all become Nightmare fans before they really started work. And yeah, it was just a really, it was just a fun atmosphere in the beginning, much like kind of a big camp, you know, lots of kids, lots of everyone's trying to be cool and get to know each other. And there's romances and, you know, it's just like what you throw any group of young 17, 18, 19 year old kids together. I was the oldest of the group. And so, I always felt more like a big sister than I did a co-star sometimes. And that was nice.
That probably helped a little bit with your role too. Like you're the guide in part 3, you know,
I'm guiding them and, you know, I'd already been kind of familiar with the way that we filmed Nightmare One. So I kind of knew, I knew a little bit about, you know, making horror movies from, you know, Wes's example. And I was, you know, I think I often would have little, you know, conferences with Chuck Russell because I was feeling like, well, we're not kind of doing it in the same, with the same, you know, energy, or we're not doing it this way. And I, you know, I brought in a lot of preconceived notions of like what you're supposed to do when you're going to be the heroine of a horror movie based on what Wes had taught me. And so I kind of had to relearn how to be, because Chuck wanted something quite different, I think. And, oh, my dogs are coming in. And so that was hard for me, actually, is setting aside everything I was kind of hoping for with Wes Craven's direction, how we communicated and did things, and then how Chuck did things was very different. And he and Roy Wagner, actually, they were, you know, a real duo putting the shots together. It was a much more complicated movie in a lot of ways because there's so many kids in the scenes. It's very difficult to have more than like two or three people in a scene. It's just really tough to block. It's really tough to get coverage on all the kids without, you know, spending 4 or 5 days on a scene. So they were looking at time and how to manage time. And so, the story too, you know, I had to play a different kind of character entirely. And so I think I didn't feel 100%. I don't know. I just didn't feel like I had graduated to feeling like a leading lady, romantic lead, like the script kind of was indicating. And I think they just kind of threw that whole idea out the window when they, I don't know. I just didn't feel like it was appropriate in that movie to, like, to have this love story. I don't know. I never loved that part of it.
You know, that's, it's almost forgotten in my eyes, like the love interest element. But you're right; it doesn't quite fit.
It didn't. I mean, they tried to like. I think they tried to create tension so that, you know, Craig Wasson's character and my character fall in love. But with all that was going on, it just didn't seemed to me to be very realistic to have this be like a concern of Nancy's at this time when there's so many kids' lives on the line. Mm-hmm. And I really balked against making that a big part of the movie. And I think Craig got the message from me. And so as a result, I don't know, I'd love to ask him in retrospect, like, when did you, we guys just like decide to jettison that love interest idea? Because It just made the movie like a little bit too corny or something. I don't know, just like too formulaic. And I'm glad that they didn't pursue it, frankly. Yeah.
It might have taken away from Welcome to Primetime or something.
Well, it's kind of like when Nancy, yeah, like in the first movie, she's like, not tonight, Glenn. You know, we're mm-hmm. here for Tina, not ourselves. Like I say that and it's kind of the same feeling that Nancy has in Nightmare 3. Like she's there to help these kids, not to like get a boyfriend. And that's why Nancy is really different. And she always has been.
She's one of, if you not know, the strongest female characters.
She's just very focused. Yeah. She's just very focused on what she feels is important at the moment, which is life and death of these people and herself included.
Right. It was the first time I can remember seeing a female lead or character fighting and like not backing down and not cowering in the corner and tripping and being all a fumbling fool, you know, like it reminded me.
People say that, but the thing is, that you're not remembering. There's dozens and dozens of examples of women in film who are just so kick ass. I mean, starting with, you know, Dorothy in A Wizard of Oz and on through. There's so many examples, but people do say that to me all the time. And I'm like, didn't you see like the African Queen or like, didn't you see these movies where women or like, you know, the Poseidon Adventure or, you know, all those great disaster movies of the 70s. There's always like somebody who was really brave, who was, you know, one of the women in the show. So I've always thought that was not a weird thing at all. I always thought it was pretty normal. And, but people like to say that. So it makes me feel like, for them or for that time in American, you know, in America in the 70s and 80s, we really were trying to put women on an equal foot as men. Mm-hmm. And this movie really demonstrates that very well. But there have been examples in the past, I think, of.
Yeah, when I think of horror, really, though, like the it's either the bumbling woman at that time in the 80s slasher flicks. It's like the bumbling lady, or it's the psychotic lady who's the killer, you know, like there really wasn't the heroine lady. Yeah, necessarily.
Like, maybe you're, I mean,
yeah. I think it's the horror genre.
The horror genre, you're right. I mean, that was something that, it was more common to see the women. Yeah. To see the woman be like the victim and the sex object and all of those things. I've not seen enough horror movies in my life because I just don't, I'm too scared.
Heather.
So the woman who makes horror movies.
Yeah. I was going through and I'm thinking about it.
I don't like it.
I'm thinking of I'm even scared of being in the midnight club. I'm thinking of like all these different, you know, movies that you've been tied to over the years. Like, I mean, the Dawn of the Dead and like everything that people probably don't know about you. It's funny to hear you say.
Well, zombie movies, I don't think zombie movies are really that scary, actually. I've never thought zombie movies are very scary. Or, you know, there's some, the haunted house movies aren't that scary to me either. But there's just some, you know, homicidal maniac movies I don't like. And I don't like a lot of really sadistic gore. I just really don't like that. And I feel like sometimes it's the more the gore that I just don't like to watch than the plots I enjoy. I do say,
yeah,
they're all very fun. And they all have like, they're all kind of silly in the, at the base of their, you know, they're all, some of them are really silly actually.
Very true.
So let me ask this question. You mentioned how, you know, you had an opinion about what Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one, was and how, you know, successful it was. And then you're called back to do the third. And you mentioned that, you know, meeting the kids on set, they were fans of the franchise and the movies. Does getting back in the saddle for three and maybe receiving some praise from a younger generation regarding your previous role, does that change your perspective on maybe kind of what you're doing and what that franchise was up until that point?
I think that the franchise was kind of in its infancy still, even still. When that movie came out, it did okay. You know, it didn't really make a lot of money at all. I mean, if you looked at the box office, Nightmare 4, I think, made the most money of all the Nightmares, because by then it really, the ball was rolling downhill at that point. And all the marketing deals had been made and all the licensing had been, you know, the worldwide licensing had started to happen. So people saw Freddy costumes and sweaters and gloves and toys and toasters, and literally they marketed every single t-shirt. I mean, lunch boxes, like that period of time, which was like maybe the late 80s. Yeah, that's when the marketing geniuses at New Line just went crazy getting Freddy's face out there. And that's kind of the same time around Nightmare 3, Nightmare 4, where it did kind of explode at that time. And you saw little kids dressed like Freddy at Halloween. That was like the one thing I really noticed is like, oh my God, there's little Freddy's at Halloween. And so I knew that he was like a cult, you know, cult icon. And that happened, I'd say like 3 or 4 years after Nightmare on Elm Street came out. Whereas, you know, David and I worked on American Horror Story. And literally when my husband designed Twisty the Clown, literally the next day after it was on TV, there were people dressed like Twisty the Clown. And so I saw that was a much faster ramp up to this, you know, I guess fandom has just taken on this whole new power, and it just has so much, their enthusiasm just skyrockets characters, you know, into the popular culture immediately. Some of them. So that's like Art the Clown as well. Like the movie came out and he was already like a superstar. So that's happening much faster now because of the streaming and so many different ways people can watch movies, that it just took a lot longer than people think it did. And finally, you know, I do feel like we were on part of a big franchise, I'd say, like, you know, 6 or 7 years after we had made Nightmare. So I'd say like in 1990 or so.
So was there any discussion in bringing you back for 4 or anything there after, but before we get to New Nightmare? Interesting.
No, because I feel like I'm really tied to the Wes, you know, his concept of the Nightmare series. So when Wes ever had an opportunity to be in control of the story, he would have Nancy be there. But otherwise, I think Bob Shea was, you know, the producer was busy thinking of how Nightmare could keep going. And I think one of his brilliant moves was he would have really young writers come in and do a take on what they thought Freddy would be doing next. And looking at the culture and like what's going on in our culture, what could we bring into a new Nightmare movie that would kind of move along with where our culture was moving. And so he had this, the greatest, you know, Rennie Harlan and, you know, getting the young writers involved kept Nightmare really fresh, never using the same people twice, except, I mean, he used Wes, but kept everything really fresh and moving fast. And I think that, you know, they were cranking out movies like one a year, you know, or one every year and a half.
Yeah.
So they were just, they had a factory of, and they really knew what they were doing. And Bob Shea, you know, he was a genius.
Yeah. They ran with it once.
Making Freddy this household name. And you know, just doesn't happen that often.
True.
Yeah. And it's just, it's awesome to see too, how long Freddy has lived since then, right? Especially with the reboot back in 2010, you know, that found a new audience. But even to this day, you'd be hard pressed to find even young children today who don't know who Freddy is. It's just one of those names that they, you know, as a testament to what you were just saying, they really did a good job at, you know, folding him into the genre and the culture. And he, you know, it exists to this day. So it's fantastic.
And I mean, I really do feel that Freddy is so different because, you know, most you know, boogeymen in movies, they're killing people and it's over. You know, it's like, it's just like they're killing you and then you're dead. But with Freddy, you know, there's like this kind of warm up to it. Then there's these funny lines around it. And then there's this really artistically directed, like very challenging, you know, filmic creation, which is their death scene, which is usually really magnificent. And then, you know, it's a big production. Each death is a huge production at number. It's not just he jumps out, you know, from behind a tree and you're dead. Sure. And that's, you know, I just think it's the secret of Freddy's success, because in all of that production, you can really appreciate Freddy in a way that sometimes you don't appreciate other boogeymen as much. I mean, they're powerful and they can kill you, but there's just so much more to a Freddy, you know, killing you than, I mean, it takes days to shoot some of his scenes, you know, like that bedroom scene it took days, you know, to get that ready to shoot and do it. And just how complicated most of the scenes are. That Taryn, you know, when she gets stabbed with the needles, I mean, that was just an incredible makeup effect and a new glove for that. And, you know, her hair, like everything about that whole scene was just a big production. It wasn't just like she's just sitting there like in her normal street clothes and she gets, you know, slashed. And I think people really appreciate how different that is.
Welcome home, Darren. Look familiar.
Okay, asshole. Let's dance.
Why should we fight? We're old friends, you and I. Remember?
Let's get high.
Yeah, I think there's you know, one thing about Freddy that I don't think a lot of people realize, or maybe even talk about if they do realize, is that, at least for me, the thing with Freddy is that he was a boogeyman before we knew of the burnt nightmare stalker. He was a boogeyman in real life before he died, you know, the preying on children and things like that. So, you know, before, and he's just evil all the way through in that sense. And I think that's what gives him a little bit of a scare. Yeah.
And he's that kind of evil that it's kind of an anomaly of nature. Like, when someone is that bad, like, you always wonder, luckily there's not that many of them, or, you know, in the world, but, you know, something goes wrong and you create, a person or man who, you know, just hurts people, and or a woman who hurts people. And, you know, it's this terrifying idea. And, you know, especially we watch people in our midst, you know, commit terrible crimes, and we're like, they were such a nice guy. They were my neighbor. I thought that he was a really great guy. And then you realize they've done something really, really terrible. And, I kind of feel like Freddy Krueger was probably more like that guy. Like, you know, people just didn't pay attention to him, and then he was this really bad guy.
Yeah.
And then they paid a lot of attention to him.
Yeah, that's true.
Now they do.
So one's done, three's done, and then we don't see you again in the franchise until New Nightmare.
And that's when Wes Craven picks it back up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was 1994. And, so I was, you know, being an actor is like the hardest job in the world, and because it's so unpredictable and it just doesn't give you much love back. You know, you can love acting, you can love everything about it, but if you don't get work, you know, you're really frustrated a lot. And I think that was the time of my life when I was very frustrated. I'd had a baby, and in Hollywood, like, there's a certain time in your life when you can just tell, like, you've kind of gone over this hill and you're only, you know, 30, you know, it's really, it can be very demoralizing. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do next. I mean, I just didn't really think I had any future at all as an actor, and I wasn't, I just didn't really know what to do with myself. And then kind of at the lowest moment of my life, feeling really demoralized, Wes called and said, "You won't believe this, but I have sold this other idea to Bob Shea. It's another Nightmare on Elm Street, and you're in it. And would you be in it?" And my heart just like leapt out of my chest. I mean, I really couldn't believe it. And it was a dream come true. It was, my prayers were being answered. And then he's like, "But wait, I have to tell you one more thing." And I was like, "Oh no." And he's like, "You have to play yourself." And I was like, "No, I don't want to do that. So dumb. I'm so gimmicky. I don't want to do that."
It felt gimmicky at the time.
Really. oh yeah, I was like, this is, I mean, I hadn't read the script yet. I'm like, oh, this is going to be so dumb. So he sent the script over and I read it and I just was like, ugh. I mean, I can see what he was doing and it was really smart and it was really a cool idea, but it just would have taken a really great director to pull it off. And luckily Wes is a really great director because it could have been really bad. And, you know, my husband and my real husband was like, I don't know, Heather, like it's just the kind of thing that is weird. And in Hollywood, sometimes weird does not fly, you know, quirky or weird. Right. But once, you know, and getting the part was, I guess, the easy part. And I was like, oh, well, no one else can play Heather Langenkamp. I guess it's mine. but believe it or not, it wasn't. Oh, my dogs are, what are you doing? But actually, like, we had a very, we had a very lively, like, there was a very lively negotiation about, because I really felt like it was my third Nightmare movie. Like, I really felt like I should deserve a certain level of pay that was equal to, not equal to Robert. Like, you know, as a woman in film, we were all really fighting to, like, get these, our, you know, get our just desserts here with, you know, our pay. And they're like, no, you know, what is hire someone else to play Heather Langenkamp. I'm like, what? But anyway, it was not as easy to like actually get that role in terms of as I thought it would be, you know, because Hollywood was still very, you know, just women just don't have power. I'll just say it that way. So once that was all behind me, I just decided, okay, I'm going to throw myself into this part. Like it's the, you know, the most important thing that I can do with my life. And I put all my trust in Wes Craven. He always knows how to get the best out of me. And I trust him so implicitly to know what he's doing as a filmmaker. And he had me doing crazy things in that movie. But he just is such a trust. He just inspired trust in me all the time. I never, ever felt like that. My initial feelings that this is going to be weird and corny and not going to, no one's going to believe it. All of that. I didn't have that thought one time again. I just decided to believe that it was amazing and going to be the best movie ever. You know, it's like, I just flipped to really be the biggest fan of this idea. And so me and the rest of the crew, we really gave it our all. And we did feel like it was a very inspired script once we actually started making it. Once we kind of got our minds around what Wes was doing, we really appreciated how novel and one of a kind, groundbreaking, all of those things that it is. And people always say like, oh, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 7, I love that movie so much. And I love Scream so much. And, you know, they're so different. People always want to put them in the same basket. But Nightmare 7 was the first time that Wes Craven brought this idea of not breaking the fourth wall necessarily, but bringing actors into the movie themselves with their own story about the movie that they just made a few years ago. Like it was that crazy time thing. And from that, you know, Kevin Williamson was inspired to write Scream, which borrowed a lot of that meta universe idea to his script. And then just by chance, Wes Craven really wanted to do a horror movie to kind of get his career like boosted again. And he just said, he said yes to directing that movie. And so Wes gave his whole style to that series, you know, bringing another incredible franchise to birth. But I really always do think that New Nightmare was the real birth of that entire just I guess you call it new idea about how to make a horror movie and self-reflecting and kind of all that, you know, they use the word meta, all that. Wes really invented that. And he, you know, was so passionate about it. So I love the movie. It's one of my favorite horror movies.
I agree.
Yeah, 100%. I remember seeing it in the theaters, you know, as a, I think I was 13, 14 at the time, and just such a huge fan of the franchise anyways, but it was really the first movie of the franchise that I was able to actually see in the theater. And I don't know, maybe it's just that, or just because of the way that movie is crafted, that I love it wholeheartedly. I think one of the silliest things that I love about New Nightmare is the fact that Lynn Shay is in it, because she's in the first one. She's Nancy's teacher. And then we see her as a nurse in New Nightmare. And I love Lynn Shay and everything she does. So it's awesome.
Oh, I know. Isn't she so good?
Oh my God. She's so fun.
There's a lot of little Easter eggs in New Nightmare, just like that. The death scenes in that movie are really interesting and really, really amazing. You know, when Dylan's in the hospital, and yeah, it's amazing.
So tying back to what we were talking about earlier in your kind of early, how do I want to say this? Your perception of what that franchise was, and you know, the success of those movies kind of leading up to three and then a little bit thereafter. You travel a lot with Robert to do a lot of these conventions, and I know that your guys's booths sell out. There's the longest line. So being 20 years removed from, you know, those movies, or you know, a little bit more than that, how does that feel for you when you look back about how you thought about it then to what it is now?
Well, there's a really funny scene in Wes Craven's New Nightmare where Wes and I are backstage at a talk show, and I've just done the talk show. I'm the guest at the talk show, and yet it gets kind of completely, you know, overrun by Freddy fans, because Freddy comes through and like does his thing, and the fans go nuts. And Wes has a funny line in there, like, you know. It's all about Freddy. And I have to say, like, for most of my, you know, I'd say for the first 20 years after the movie came out, it was really all about Freddy. I mean, it would be very hard for you to, you wouldn't believe me, but like, if when I would go into these events with Robert, there was nobody coming to my table, like very few people. And I actually, you know, I totally understood it. I mean, the world had been told to love Freddy Krueger, you know, they marketed Freddy Krueger just so intensely, and he was the star of 8 movies. And so it was no surprise to me that, you know, he's the superstar. And, you know, we would often joke about it, you know, and in fact, when we were making, my husband and I were making Cabin in the Woods, I called Wes's office to see if he wanted to go to a screening of A Nightmare on Elm Street that was in LA. And his secretary was like, okay, how do you spell your last name, Heather? You know, and like, and who are you? And I'd be like, yeah, Heather Langenkamp, you know, and I was spelling my name, and I hung up the phone, and I just was like, okay. And my sister-in-law said, I just can't believe that just happened. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it happens all the time. Like, it's no big deal. And she's like, no, you should have told her, I am Nancy. Turn around and look at that poster hanging on the wall. You see that name? And so my sister-in-law just went on this total rant about just how wrong it was. And this, like, this just, it just showed you how screwed up Hollywood is. And I said, you know, relax, it's totally fine. And she says, no, we're making a movie about this. And so she went to her in-laws, who had a bunch of money, and got some money. And we made the documentary, I Am Nancy, which is all about why Freddie is so popular. And literally nobody ever mentions Nancy's name. And So we did this documentary, went all over the world, and it was really fun. And what I learned is that, you know, people love Nancy, of course. I mean, how can you, she's so, you know, she's so kick-ass and she's so amazing, but it's just that the mystique around Freddie has never really let in the other co-stars and, you know, the other people in the movie, because he doesn't need them, you know, he doesn't need us. And so making that documentary actually really helped me realize how many fans that I did have. And then I got a little bit more, love after that, because I put the documentary out and a lot of people bought it. And I think that after that, my lines grew at those events. And now, I mean, my lines will never be like Robert's, but I do feel like by standing up for myself and kind of saying, like, I am Nancy here, and this is my perspective, and meeting all the people who actually love Nancy, but just don't have a way to show it kind of thing. Now I feel very happy that, I feel like I have a fan base that is so loyal and so wonderful and are loving Nancy for all the right reasons. You know, she's confident. She cares about her friends. She works hard. She wants to solve this problem. She is smart, you know, and she tackles her fears head on and, you know, tries to figure out, you know, what the hell's happening. So all of those qualities of Nancy are things that, you know, my fans tell me they really admire.
That's really good. So enough about Nancy, right? What has Heather been doing?
Yeah, enough about Nancy.
What has Heather been doing since?
Well, so I did that. I did that Netflix TV series for Mike Flanagan, which was really fun. And we did 10 episodes.
I saw that.
In Canada.
Did you know that episode 1 holds the Guinness Book World Record for the most jump scares in a single episode?
Isn't that, I know he wrote that for that, and that, and I guess that purpose, because I can't remember, somebody said, oh, I hate jump scares, or I love jump scares. I don't know what it was, but he decided just to try to break the Guinness Book of World Records. So that one, a lot of people hate jump scares. It's one of the reasons people don't like horror movies, is that they can't handle what happens to your body after a jump scare. So what I found, well, some of the people who are like old, like me, like the minute they saw that first episode, they're like, oh no, I can't watch this show. It's just going to be like this the whole time. And I'm like, no. Like, that was just like a gag for the first episode to get all those jump scares in. But there's really not that many for the rest of the show. And they're like, I don't believe you. But in some ways, I think it hurt the viewership, because a lot of people just really don't like jump scares. So I don't know.
The show we're talking about, of course, is The Midnight Club, right? Just in case.
It's The Midnight Club. Yeah. In the first episode. Yeah. It was really scary. It was scary. But he's so good at jump scares, and people always love the jump scare that's in The Haunting of Hill House. There's a really, really good jump scare in there that he's trying to top, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I did that. That was really fun. And we didn't get picked up, which was very disappointing. But that was like a big politics thing, I think, with Netflix and I don't know. And then, you know, I've done some movies in the interim. You know, I did a fantastic movie called Plea that my a good friend of mine directed. I've done, I didn't know how my resume in front of me, but I've done some really great little films in the last few years. And this winter, something I did with Danielle Harris and Scout Taylor Compton is coming out, called The Last Chance Motel, which is very, very good. And I play a crazy character in it, just a crazy character. People will not even believe it's me. So I can't wait for that to come out. And yeah. And I mean, I still, my husband and I still are making special makeup effects at AFX Studio in Van Nuys, California. And we're working, we did Monster Four, Monster Season 3, the Ed Gein story. So that's just out
watching that right now. So good.
And my wife is watching that right now too. Yeah.
So yeah, gory. And then now we're doing season four now. And we're working on another Ryan Murphy show called The Shards, which is very top secret. But I can say that my co-star in the Midnight Club, Igby Rigney, is also in The Shard. So that's super cool that he's in both of those. So, yeah. But so, yeah, it's being an actor in Hollywood is not easy.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of work in front of the camera and behind the camera. And I'm curious to know if you have a preference or an affinity for one over the other.
Well, I've had a few opportunities to direct like my own little short film or do some directing. And I think that would be something I would really love to do. I find that really exciting because you're really creating a universe in your own mind and telling people like, help me create this, you know, and using all the people around you to bring your vision out into reality. And I just find it so exciting. I really love our company. I think we work really hard to be as good as we can be. Like everything we make, we try to make it, you know, look great on film and tell a story and be as disgusting as they want it to be. I don't have any artistic skill really. So I stand and give a lot of opinions and my husband's, you know, designing everything and figuring out how to make it all. And once in a while I'll say, are you sure the actor is going to want to wear that all day long? You know, or that looks uncomfortable for the actor. Like I'm always bringing like what the actor is going to think of this thing. And we have a gag that's working in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, I don't think the actor is going to want to use that, you know, or touch that. So I'm always thinking about it from the actor's point of view.
That's awesome.
I mean, when I think of some of the work that your guys' studio has done, I can see why you would think that someone doesn't want to touch that. Because, I mean, you guys have basically created what the modern zombie looks like. I mean,
it's pretty amazing. Oh, that's such a nice compliment. I know my husband really worked hard on those zombies for Dawn of the Dead. And a lot of it was Zack Snyder, of course, like saying, I want them to be this and I want them to be that. And you know, oftentimes a director will give you just some adjectives that you have to translate into visuals, and he would say, you know, putrefied, fast, you know, fleshy, you know, like whatever the words are, then David will take them home and just dream and close his eyes and try to think about what those words mean with the script too, and then he and his illustrator will just draw the ideas. Or we'll actually just pull someone in and do a makeup on them so that we can see in real life, like, is this going to look good? And we test out things a lot to see, you know, is it as scary as they want it to be? But it's really fun to watch that process happen from just the few little words that are in the script to finally seeing like something real in front of you. It's a, you know, can take months, it can take weeks. I mean, sometimes it can just take days, but watching that process happen is kind of my favorite part.
I bet. Do you find yourself becoming the guinea pig in some of those experiments?
I have been a guinea pig before, but in general, yeah, I don't volunteer for that anymore.
There's someone else for that.
Someone else can do that. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so I have a question for you, as I mentioned at the beginning, that it's a Nightmare on Elm Street question. Hopefully it's one that no one has ever asked you before.
Oh, I can't wait. Okay.
Okay. So in that same, for that same event that I mentioned where I had shown up on a Sunday hoping that you would be there and finding out that you weren't, Ronnie Blakely was there. She plays Nancy's mom in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
And my wife and I just got done watching Nightmare, like right before that. And it dawned on me in that last watching that, I think her name was Marge. Marge felt like she had a career. Like she, there were times throughout the movie where she was dressed very elegantly, like she had just left or come back from, you know, was either leaving to work or coming back from work or whatever it was. And then it dawned on me that, you know, she's a single mother, really nice house, you know, really everything, nice neighborhood. And it, I thought to myself, does she have a career? What does she do? What is that character do? And so I asked Ronnie, and we had a really good conversation about it, and she gave me an answer, but I'm curious to know if you know or if the answer is the same.
Guys, that is the best question ever.
Let's go.
So I never talked about that with Ronnie, but yeah, because that was the age of divorce when, you know, even stay-at-home moms who got divorced, yeah, they'd have to get some kind of a job because he's a cop. He's probably not able to pay that much alimony, right? To her. Right. Not to, so that could have been a family house. I don't know. Maybe the mortgage wasn't that high. And the back in those days, the mortgages weren't that expensive. But let's just assume she had to get a job. I think she could have been a very good executive assistant to like some really horrible like banker, but that's more of a full-time job. She was home more.
That's a good answer considering like the temperament of Marge Thompson, right? And some of the attitude or perceptions that she holds, especially with her affinity for drinking as well. So I could see where like I had a shitty day at work and then I want to come home and, you know, have a drink or whatever.
I kind of think like she's been, beat on by her boss all day, but also she could have been a really good real estate agent.
Oh, that's a good one too.
Yeah. Create her own schedule.
I think too. She could have been a good real, because you're kind of in managing your own time. You don't have to necessarily be gone all day, every day. You can, you know, have your open houses on Thursdays or whatever. But putting up the bars on the windows would have devalued the house a great deal. So I think she would have been aware of that as a real estate
agent. Well, Ronnie,
and then
Ronnie,
taking down that gorgeous rose trellis, it would have been a big mistake.
Yeah. Ronnie, when we asked Ronnie the question, she said that Marge Thompson was an artist. And the way that she kind of helped incorporate that into the film is that there are different paintings around the house that Ronnie had painted, that she was allowed to put up around the house. So she
Now that you're mentioning that, yeah, and, you know, artists make so much money. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So she played the character as an artist.
That's so Ronnie. Ronnie, you know, because Ronnie was a singer and she's a true artist. Ronnie is an artist through and through. That would have made a lot of sense that she would wanted to bring that into the movie. I wish I had remembered that, but good on you. I was thinking more of like, Marge's drinking temperament. Like, what jobs drive you to that? So
yeah, that's a good train of thought there. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Poor thing. That her character. Yeah, she was doomed from the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So any, are there any fun, special memories regarding 1, 3, or 7 that really kind of stand out for you, or, you know, a story you like to tell regarding either one of those that you want to share with us?
I have to say, like, the death scene my death scene is a really, was a really emotional and an amazing day of work. I don't think I'll ever forget it. Just working with Patricia Arquette in that scene and watching her work and just her heartbreaking performance. And, you know, so many people tell me that they cry, and they cry because, you know, Patricia's really crying. Like, she's in a place that, you know, you're just really privileged when you're working on a set and somebody trusts you and everybody around you that much that they let themselves just show that raw emotion. So that in terms of acting, I think that was one of my favorite days. But also like the day that Taryn gets killed, I just remember like nobody knew how to do a mohawk, you know, like we didn't have any punk rock, you know, like punkers on our crew. And it was so funny, like trying to get her hair to stand up and it took a little while. And of course, I don't think they really did it with the right products. It was always kind of like wiggly, but they finally got it to look pretty good. And she looked so different, you know, than I had ever seen her. And then seeing the prosthetics and that whole scene, we all went down to watch it because it just seemed like a big event. And all of us were standing behind the camera. And what we don't know, what you don't know, is that Robert had like probably 20 different taglines for that. You know, What a Rush was the one they picked. But I think there was like five, it seemed like there was always other ones that he would always throw other ideas out there when he was doing those kills. And, you know, it was just like watching Robert working in such a painfully like disgusting and horrible scene, especially for kids who are, you know, who do have problems with drugs. I always felt like that scene to me was going to, it was just a death that, I mean, a lot of people since then, you know, experienced. And I just felt like it was so raw and so, it was so true. You know, it was just so true. What's your Freddy? Your Freddy is heroin, or, you know, that's a big Freddy, right?
I mean, the DARE campaign was still huge at that time, right? So
yeah,
it tied it just, right yeah. into it.
Yeah, it was, though the drug scene wasn't as bad as it got to be. Still, you know, it wasn't for me growing up common at all to know anybody who was doing heroin. I mean, or injectable, yeah, heroin. And so that to me, it was very scary in and of itself, just because I didn't personally really have an acquaintance with seeing that or watching it or understanding it. And it just really scared me. And even today, I just always get that scene always gives me the creeps. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Rightfully so.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to sit with us and, you know, just chat a little bit. And
you're so excited. Welcome. I know you're going to have a great night. Yeah. Thanks for the interview. I really appreciate it. And yeah, that poster signed. We'll figure it out.
Yes. Okay. Sounds good.
Maybe you come by AFX Studio. Why don't you do that? And you can come and
take you up on that for anytime. Yeah, 100%. So maybe we can get talk when you come back from the convention when spooky season's over and things have settled down a little bit. We can figure something out.
Okay, sounds good.
Awesome.
All right.
Thank you,
guys. So enjoy. Good luck. All right, Mutant City. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.